thank you. So I did this work with my advisor, John Dighton, and we are at Rutgers University. So most of you probably have heard a little bit about switchgrass. It's a crop that has been a focus for bioenergy production since like the 1980s. So there's been plenty of work done breeding different varieties, working on biomass production, et cetera, et cetera. For me, it's great to work in this system because I'm looking at the soil ecology. So there's not a lot of work that has been done with Calendula and mites. So it's nice to work with a plant that has a lot of research behind it. Switchgrass is a potentially great biofuel crop because it, especially with all the breeding, has low irrigation and fertilizer requirements. And since it's a perennial crop, and the idea is to harvest the same field for 10 to 20 years, you're also saving that energy expenditure of a yearly tilling. So if you have low energy input at the beginning, hopefully we can have a higher net energy yield at the end. Right now, you can compress switchgrass into pellets and use it for combustion in boilers, but many other people are working to develop cellulosic ethanol, and a newer technology is creating syngas from cellulosic materials. So maybe we'll see the commercialization of this. Who knows, because they've been working on it since the 1980s. My question is, over time, you know, it's potentially a 20-year life cycle of a field. Is there anything that's happening that we can see in the soil community that might have an impact on the sustainability of the crop? And sort of on the more negative side, is there anything that we can measure now that might impact the sustainability in a few years? So with that in mind, so I'm working in New Jersey, which will not be the biggest producer of switchgrass should it become commercial, but we definitely have space for it, and there was a recent grant that I was working with, the people who are working on it with, to combine like switchgrass fields with creating bird habitat and also crop fields that are on rotation. So they were trying to create a market for switchgrass in New Jersey, and it didn't quite work, but there were definitely people buying into it, and it definitely created bird habitat, so I think the potential is still there. And I am looking, my field measurements are on a six-year-old switchgrass biodiversity site that was set up by somebody else at Rutgers, which again is great because it takes 2 years to establish a switchgrass field, so if you want to get a meaningful measurement of the soil community, I don't think it's useful in the first couple years, so I'm fortunate in that respect. Even though it's a biodiversity study, I am only using the results from the switchgrass trials today, even though I took some other measurements. And then I also designed a greenhouse experiment to match the field study, in which I used the farm soil, I sterilized it, and I added fungal feeding nematodes and mycorrhizal inoculum to see if there's measurable effects on the biomass production in the green in a controlled controlled environment. So just to go over some of what I'm looking at, I'm mostly using the top 15 centimeters of the soil. When I'm measuring for the soil arthropods, I'm also including the organic layer. I'm looking for mycorrhizae. I'm looking at the arbuscular mycorrhizae, so that's the structures on the top left. Top right is a spore, and on the bottom two pictures are coils that show that the hyphae have entered the cell. So it's kind of, these three structures are kind of like the reproduction of the mycorrhizae. I'm also looking at Calendula, which are relatively easy to break down into families. I'll go over it anyway. The two large on the right and the left, those are Entomobriidae. The one in the middle is the Isotomidae. The top pale guy with no eyes is a Onychuridae. The blue guys on the left are Hypogastridae, and the little round guy in the bottom is a Sminthuridae. For mites, Calendula are mostly fungal feeding and detritivores. For mites, I only categorize it into larger groups. So I'm seeing a lot of orbatid mites, which are mostly detritivores. And the predatory mites in this system are mostly mesostigmatic mites. So you can see a time series of my site at the Adelphia Farm. Starting with the arthropods, and I have this data so far from 2013 and 2014, and I'm planning to collect some in 2015, so we might be able to see trends over time at the end of everything. So in 2013, there's not really a significant difference between the total arthropod numbers, but in 2014, it's much closer. You see a little bit of separation between the control, which is the unplanted adjacent farmland, and you see that there's more arthropods in the switchgrass fields. And there's a slight trend that there's more arthropods in both years in the fertilized fields. When you break it out into groups, you do have some significant differences that are statistically significant. In 2013, the sort of other orobatid category was significant because there was more in the control fields. The medium-sized mesostigmatic mites, which are the second one over, they seem to be it's significant because there's less in the control site. But the large / adult mesostigmatic mites are slightly greater in the unfertilized fields than the control or the fertilized fields. And then you can see some separation between the treatments in the two Columbula on the far left, but they didn't have statistical significance. In 2014, it's a similar story, except in general, there seems to be more arthropods in the fertilized switchgrass sites. There's significant differences when you have a combination of the adult developed Columbula and the adult mites. And significant differences, again, between the medium-sized mesostigmatic mites, but that's mostly between the control and versus the switchgrass. And then you see some separation that's close to significant, but not fully significant in the other Columbula groups. When you look at mycorrhizae in 2013, there is statistical significance between all things I categorized, but in 2014, no significance developed. So hopefully, with a little bit more next year, we'll see different trends too. And notable in this, there was fungal hyphae in like essentially 100% of the samples. So what we're seeing is just a difference in the structures that they're forming. And finally, I have results from extractable nitrogen collected in 2013. There is a significant difference in ammonium, and as you might expect, it's highest in the fertilized field and lowest in the control, but no significant differences among the nitrates. I combined all the data and ran multivariate analysis, but no significance developed. I used the permutational multivariate ANOVA, and both years there was no significance. And I tried mapping the data using detrended correspondence analysis. The control is the light green on the bottom, and the unfertilized plots are the light blue, and the fertilized plots are the dark blue. And you can see they're pretty much clustered together. They're not separated out nicely. And that is also a zoom in of the graph. So it's clumped really closely together on the axes that were laid out. Moving on to the greenhouse experiment, in 2013, it was a preliminary run with a short duration, and we didn't have any fertilizer variation. It was just unfertilized soil. In 2014, it was a full season length that I'm still wrapping up now, and we included a 50-pound per year and a 100-pound per year treatment of fertilizer. And I think I forgot to say that, but in the field, the nitrogen application was 100 pounds per year. For 2013, we saw no significance, but a nice trend from low biomass when you didn't add nematodes or mycorrhizae to higher biomass when you add both, which is great and what we wanted to see, because the idea is the interaction of the fungal feeding nematodes with the mycorrhizae allows the plant to get the high benefit from the mycorrhizae, but the mycorrhizae don't dominate, and the plant still like gets the best of everything. In 2014, so like I said, we're still analyzing the results. So these graphs are the above ground biomass only. I'm still intending to harvest all the below ground biomass. So as some of you might know, that's very tedious. When there's no fertilizer added, you see a little bit of separation with the with the addition of both soil community members growing more than a single when there's single additions, and it's slightly higher than when there's no additions, but it's not the nice trend we saw in the preliminary study. At 50 pounds of per year of fertilizer, there's no difference at all. And at 100 pounds per year, you have the best growth when nothing was added. So once you do have the additions, you have a slight upward trend like we want to see, but the plants are doing better when there's nothing in the soil except the fertilizer. So to sum up that, there seem to be measurable differences. Hopefully, statistical significance will be achieved once we have all of the data gathered up and finished. And in overall, my conclusions are we are seeing in the field measurable and significant differences between fertilized and unfertilized switchgrass fields. We don't necessarily know what that means yet, but hopefully with more work, we can tease out some of the variables. And hopefully, again, we'll be able to see if there's trends over time, which we can use as a predictive, to predict things. And in the greenhouse, again, we have measurable differences, but no significant response yet. I would like to thank my advisor and the members of our lab, especially thank Dr. Stacy Banos, who set up the biodiversity site and has allowed me to use it, and the Rutgers Adelphia Farm Extension Station. And of course, I have to thank my funding source, the Rutgers Renewable and Sustainable Fuel Solution, IGERT. With that, I'll take any questions. Yeah, it was percent of 100 views per slide. So you put like 10 centimeters on a slide and do, or two slides and do, you know, it's percent of views. So like it's essentially, yeah. So I guess essentially it's an infection.